Oh, hello there. Marge Gunderson here, Fargo PD. No, I'm just kidding. It's Daisha, and you're listening to The Classical Classroom. Welcome to part two of our two-part series on the music of the Coen Brothers films. So when we last left the boys, they had just done the Hudsucker Proxy, and this episode picks up with one of my personal favorite movies, Fargo. So sit back, relax, and I hope you don't freeze your keister off. Don't forget to subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes. Okay, I'm going to stop now. Enjoy the episode. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, here. I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me once again today is Craig Coen. If you're wondering why I'm saying it again, it is because this is part two of a two-part series that Craig and I are doing about the music of the Coen Brothers films. Just to reintroduce Craig, he's the host of our home station's daily public affairs program, Houston Matters. He's also hosted classical music programs on three stations and was a program director at one of those. He was a film critic on a TV show called Critics' Choice. He also hosted a TV show called iZone, which introduced independent films. And as I mentioned in the last episode, Craig has interviewed Muppets. So, Craig, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So last time, we left our guests frozen in midair, just like Norval Barnes, with the music of the Hudsucker Proxy. Where do we go next?
We go next to the next Coen Brothers film. In 1996, they wrote and directed Fargo.
Ah, yeah.
Great film.
So great.
And of course, for those who have not seen it, I can't imagine there are many who haven't, but let me just give the brief synopsis here. William H. Macy manages a car dealership. He has money troubles, so he enlists two really skeevy characters, played by Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare, really terrific casting, by the way, to kidnap his wife in the hopes that his father-in-law will pay the ransom. Of course, it all goes wrong, and it is up to our hero, Marge Gunderson, the sheriff, Francis McDormand again, to figure out what's happened. In this film, we've been talking about Carter Burwell, with whom the Coen brothers have collaborated on most of their films. Burwell uses mostly just a few instruments, a harp, a celeste, and a Hardinger fiddle, to just a real minimalist kind of instrumentation in his score for this, which makes sense because you think, there's a real sense of isolation about this film.
Right.
You know, you're up north, there's snow everywhere, one lonely car traveling down a road. That's Fargo, right?
Right.
And so he sort of combines the minimalist sound with those visuals and all these isolated characters. I am reminded of a phrase my dad likes to say, which is, ethics are what we do in the dark. You know, when nobody's looking, how do you behave?
Right.
And Fargo, the movie, is kind of all about that.
Yeah.
And that this sense of in an isolated situation, how will you be a person or not?
That's interesting.
You know,
I've never really thought like the isolation of the place, the sort of almost desolation of the place.
Yes.
You know, that those big shots of the snowy landscape that just go on forever, and it is very desolate looking, but like that, the isolation too of the characters.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And every character.
Yeah.
I mean, now look, Marge Gunderson and her husband, the two of them seem to have found their way. Mm-hmm. But so many of the characters, remember the friend, the former classmate that she meets up with, who talks about how lonely he is. There's a point in the film where William H. Macy's character is scraping ice off of the windshield, and he just is overcome with frustration, and he starts smacking the windshield with the scraper that he's using. And you just get this sense of these people being overcome with this isolation. Mm-hmm. The disconnect he has with his wife, his father-in-law, mm-hmm. with his kid, his son, who seems, it's like he disregards how all of this is impacting his son, mm-hmm. which is something that never really gets explored in the film. But all of these characters are just trying to go about their lives in this desolate place. And so it makes sense that you would want to have sort of this isolation of just a few instruments sort of expressing that.
Yeah, let's hear some of that. Oh, I forgot how great the theme is.
And Burwell was going for a Scandinavian folk music kind of feel
with
this. And this is a piece called The Lost Sheep.
Okay.
And all the characters, all those characters are lost sheep, aren't
they?
Yeah.
Well, in that Midwestern sort of the kind of Scandinavian influence on the accent there.
Oh, yeah,
too, like,
absolutely.
That really fits.
And also on the personality of these characters, that that most of the time they don't say really what they're thinking.
Uh-huh. It's all very polite.
It's very polite.
Yeah.
You know, Marge saying, there's no need to get snippy with me, sir. I'm just doing my job, you know? But then when somebody does break down or break through, it's a shock to the system for everybody. Yeah. Again, we go back to that scene where Marge meets this guy that she used to know, mm-hmm. who breaks down as they're having dinner, and there's a look on Frances McDormand's face like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here or how I'm supposed to handle this.
Emotions are happening.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
And then as this gets a little more intense, we've gotten into the true crime elements of it, the murder, the mayhem that is the hallmark of, you know, Miller's Crossing and Blood Simple, and the Coen brothers are back kind of in their wheelhouse with that.
Definitely. Oh, so good. And they continue to use this theme in the music. I know the Coen brothers are, I think, executive producers on the Fargo TV show, and I believe they continue to use this theme in the music for the TV show.
Well, you would have to, wouldn't you?
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
Okay, where do we go next?
1998, The Big Lebowski. Initially, I just wanted to talk about it just so I got the chance to say the dude abides. But there's a couple of good reasons to talk about it. This is the first collaboration the Coen brothers have with T-Bone Burnett.
Okay.
Now, if you're not familiar with T-Bone Burnett, he toured with Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
He is a music producer who has recorded Roy Orbison, recorded Elvis Costello, a lot of Leon Russell, a lot of the really great rock and roll figures of the like 60s, 70s, 80s, even up to today. And he really came to prominence in part because of Coen Brothers films. He also won an Oscar for Best Original Song in the film Crazy Heart.
Mm.
He is very well respected in the industry. And they went to him because they needed him to curate some dude music, essentially.
Yeah.
So they knew they wanted to play, they wanted the Eagles in the mix in this film, which makes sense. I guess maybe we should explain who the dude is.
Yeah, the dude.
For people who don't know. Jeff Bridges plays the dude.
Mm-hmm.
The dude's last name is Lebowski, but he doesn't really make any issue with that because he's the dude.
He's the dude.
Everybody knows him as the dude.
Yeah.
There's another guy named Lebowski. David Huddleston plays him, and he's a very well-to-do figure who is mired in this real soap opera of a situation. Mm-hmm. Epic, awful things happening. Another kidnapping may be in the mix here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the two are confused for one another in a certain way.
Yeah.
And are brought together, if you might say. Mm-hmm. Either force is bringing them together, or maybe one of the characters is bringing the other one together. But I don't want to get into all of that because, you know, spoilers.
Yeah.
So what's interesting about all this is that the reason I bring up this plot and I bring up the songs that T-Bone came up with, you know, music by Captain Beefheart and the Eagles, as well as some other artists mm-hmm. that were appropriate for the dude music,
yeah.
A stoner, I guess I haven't really described again who the dude is other than that he's the dude.
Yeah. He seems perpetually stoned.
Yes.
He
is absolutely perpetually stoned. He is living a very simple life. Uh-huh. He's pretty much, he's that guy that's just always in a bathrobe, you know? He's just yeah. hasn't shaved in, I don't know, 10 years,
yeah.
you know? He's just, he's there. He's yeah. fine. Hangs out at a bowling alley with his buddy John Goodman, who swears a lot. And his other buddy Steve Buscemi, who doesn't get to say much because John Goodman's swearing a lot. And then you have David Huddleston, who is this larger-than-life figure in this epic moment in his life, really kind of breaking down emotionally.
Yeah.
And so you need a contrast in music. Uh-huh. So the contrast to the dude music, the Captain Beefheart and the Eagles, is Mozart's Requiem. You can't do better than Mozart's Requiem in this context. Now, I know you've on a previous episode, you've talked a little bit about Mozart's Requiem.
A little bit, yeah.
Just sort of a reminder, the short version. This was the last piece that Mozart composed before he died, and he did not finish it. This was back in the days when composers were commissioned to create works for an event, what have you. And this was to write a requiem for someone's funeral mass.
Yeah.
And when he didn't finish this and he died, then his fiancée had somebody else finish the composition.
Uh-huh.
And there is a whole mythology associated with Mozart's Requiem
yeah.
that's mostly bogus, some of which involves a play from the 19th century called Mozart and Salieri,
yeah.
In which the suggestion is made that Antonio Salieri, one of Mozart's contemporaries, was actually there at his deathbed
mm-hmm.
Helping him compose and maybe involved in the commissioning of the work and maybe in some way, in some insidious way, involved in his death.
Uh-huh.
And this, of course, then was the structure, the basis for Peter Schaeffer's play, which also became the film
Amadeus.
By Milos Forman, Amadeus.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the whole long story. Of course, none of that is true.
Oh, it's such a good,
it's a great story.
Yummy story.
But now somebody else tried to finish it. And there's yeah. still some disputes among classical music scholars over who actually finished Mozart's Requiem, but it's probably this one guy, and whatever.
Yeah.
The way the Coen brothers use this, they use it in this great scene between David Huddleston and Jeff Bridges. Mm-hmm. They're the two Lebowskis, the big and the
dude, bathrobed. Yeah.
And the bathrobed. And clearly, Jeff Bridges, Lebowski, the dude, is completely out of his element and completely oblivious to what's yeah. going on.
We've had some terrible news. Mr. Lebowski's in seclusion in the West Wing. Mr. Lebowski.
Funny. I can look back on a life of achievement.
So first we hear David Huddleston, actor David Huddleston, as the big Lebowski. And then obstacles we're going to hear, overcome. And then there's Jeff Bridges, who's the dude. And you can definitely hear, Huddleston's the one doing all the talking.
Without
the use of my legs. What? What makes a man, Mr. Lebowski?
Dude.
Huh?
I don't know, sir.
is it being prepared to do the right thing? Whatever the cost. Isn't that what makes a man?
Sure, that and a pair of testicles.
Joking.
Okay, so the scene goes on from there. So what's happening to David Huddleston's Lebowski, at least so far as we know at this point in the film, is that his beloved Bunny Lebowski has been kidnapped. And he is going through this emotionally wrenching moment, soul-searching, talking about what makes a man. And then the dude's just totally, you know, what, huh? He's facing. So my favorite part of this whole thing, though, is as Mozart's Requiem is playing in the background, which, again, it makes sense, you know, somebody going through something emotionally wrenching like that, it fits. Jeff Bridges' character leaves with Philip Seymour Hoffman to go speak in the hallway. The door shuts behind them, and the music goes down in volume but does not go out. You can still subtly hear it in the background, which means that David Huddleston's Big Lebowski was not just feeling Mozart's Requiem. He was actually listening to Mozart's Requiem as he's delivering this monologue.
Mr. Lebowski is prepared to make a generous offer to you to act as courier.
That's brilliant. I love it. They're ridiculous, the Coen brothers.
Yes, they are.
So where do we go from Mozart's Requiem and the dude?
Well, now we go to the Odyssey set in Depression-era Mississippi.
Yes.
It's Oh Brother, Where Art Thou from 2000. George Clooney, John Turturro, Tim Blake Nelson, the three convicts on the run who go on their own Odyssey, which culminates in their being recorded and mistaken as bluegrass stars, the Foggy Bottom Boys. One thing I want to mention, just a little bit of trivia, and this is because I host a show called Houston Matters, and we're recording this at Houston Public Media. There's a character that Charles Durning plays in this film named Pappy O'Daniel, who is based on a real-life figure named Pappy O'Daniel, who was the governor of Texas.
What?
And who did host his own radio show that was broadcast throughout the state.
Whoa.
Yes. They just sort of co-opt that figure and placed him in Mississippi instead of Texas.
Huh.
So this film has a really great soundtrack, again, curated by, I use the term curated, I don't know how else to call it.
Yeah.
You know, these folks these days that will basically decide which songs from popular culture seem to fit the mood of this particular film. Yeah. Basically, everybody trying to be Quentin Tarantino, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much what they have T-Bone Burnett do in this film as well. And he takes contemporary artists, he has them sing folk music and country music and blues and gospel, all songs from the Depression era. And among them, of course, is the song I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I always think of this kind of music, like bluegrass music, as kind of another sort of classical music in a way, because it's very much of a place. It's very much indicative of a people. It was very much sort of composed in a way. You know, we've done shows about classical music in non-Western countries, like this sort of fits that bill in a way, I think, at least. That's my very humble, uninformed opinion. But
well, you know what Tom Lehrer once said about folk music? He said, the only problem with folk music is it was written by the people. And that's kind of what this is a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think you can credit T-Bone Burnett and I guess Dolly Parton as the two figures who sort of brought bluegrass and folk music back around the year 2000.
Yeah, and the music in this film is just, it's just great. It's something I never thought that I personally would be into, but it's just, it's so good. Okay, we have to hear some.
Yes.
In constant sorrow all through his days, I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days. I bid farewell.
And George Clooney's character is lip syncing this.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Let's give credit where it's due.
Yeah.
That's actually Dan Tominski singing along with Harley Allen and Pat Enright. Those are the actual people singing, not George Clooney, John Turturro, and Tim Blake Nelson, though they do a fine job of lip syncing.
Yeah, definitely. Some high dollar lip syncing going on. I think this film is so interesting because it is a version of the Odyssey.
Yep.
Set in the least likely time period, using the least likely characters.
Like, but you know you're in for it. First of all, I mean, even in the opening credits, they say based on Homer's The Odyssey, I believe. But you know what's coming down the railroad tracks when there's a blind man telling them they're going to go on a journey who's hand cranking a cart, one of those hand carts that you push along the railroad tracks.
Yeah. What are those called?
I don't know. We'll have to look that up. Push cart? I don't know.
Okay. I feel like we've got, what, a couple left to go before we...
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So next up, let's skip ahead now to 2007 and No Country for Old Men.
Oh, yeah.
This is a fine film. Josh Brolin finds a stash of money at the site of a drug deal gone bad in rural Texas. Javier Bardem and his captive bolt pistol are after him.
He's so creepy.
The hair does it as much as the performance for me. And flipping a coin to decide who lives or dies. Oh, creepy. So how do you capture Texas and impending dread, which some see as one and the same?
Wagner? I mean.
Well, what? And again, we're back to Carter Burwell in this case. And what he decided to do was to just keep it quiet. He characterized this as the quietest film he had worked on, and so the score sort of reflects that.
So what kind of music did he use? What?
Very little.
Huh.
Very minimalist. So once again, this music captures this sense of impending dread.
Yeah.
There's a motion at play here, a chase, a cat and mouse game between Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh and Josh Brolin's Llewellyn, who really should not have picked up that money.
The instrumentation is really... It's like it reminds me a lot of some more experimental contemporary classical music that I've heard. And it is very sparse.
It's very moody.
Yeah.
But I guess the other thing I'd say, though, is to be honest with you, when I think of No Country for Old Men, I don't think of the music at all.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because it is minimalist and it's brought in subtle ways at subtle times. But the movie does not rely on the music, I think, to propel it forward in the same way that you see in a lot of other Coen Brothers films.
It's kind of used more to like bridge these empty spaces together in a way.
Well, and again, this is another one of those films that's a lot about empty spaces.
Yeah.
You know, we think of Coen Brothers films like we talked about Fargo earlier being this... being representative of this sense of isolation, these characters that can't connect with one another, and these big open landscapes. So I think the same could be said for No Country for Old Men. Yeah. There's a lot of dusty plains in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and here it's like Young Guns era Bon Jovi. Being played by Metallica.
Yeah, well, I hear more Metallica than I do Bon Jovi.
That's good. I mean, that says a lot about you as a person, I think.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, if you heard more Bon Jovi, I don't know if we could be friends.
No, it really has a little Justin Bieber vibe to it, don't you think? I'm just kidding.
Oh, the Biebs. You know, the Coen Brothers films do deal so much in that theme or trope or whatever it is of sort of empty spaces and isolation and, you know,
And characters being at a crossroads,
yeah,
but maybe not either realizing it or making really stupid decisions about it, or sometimes making no decisions at all, which in fact brings us to our next film, 2009's A Serious Man.
Way to segue.
Thank you. This is probably the Coen brothers' most personal film. It's sort of semi-autobiographical. One of the characters, the child in it, was pretty much the age these guys were in the 1960s, I suppose, 60s, 70s. But I don't really even want to talk about the story that is the basis of most of A Serious Man. I want to talk about the prologue.
Okay.
It's the most fascinating choice that they make here. It includes, remember actor Feivish Finkel?
Yes.
From Boston Public and Picket Fences.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Yeah. He plays a man in this old world shtetl who may or may not be what's called a dybbuk or a devil. And he's in this sequence, and there are a couple other actors in the sequence. And this opening scene takes place entirely in Yiddish. And you're trying to figure out, right along with the other two characters, whether this guy is just a guy or some sort of devilish figure, which in their world, one character is convinced he's a devil, the other one's convinced he's not. And it's not entirely clear even by the end of the scene what just happened. I don't want to talk anything more about it other than to say it is completely disconnected from the rest of the film. Except for one thing. There is a quote at the very beginning of this prologue by Rashi. The quote is, "Receive with simplicity everything that happens to you." And the whole point of that prologue, and I think the point of the film, is to do that. That there are events that happen in this world that cannot be explained by religion, that cannot necessarily be explained mathematically, and they just happen. And your choice is to either let them happen to you and accept them, or try to fight against it. What's interesting, I guess I do want to talk a little bit about the rest of the film. The character, the main character of the film is Larry Gopnik, who spends the entire movie saying, "I didn't do anything," as he gets into trouble. All kinds of things happen to him. And he's like Job, essentially. And he just feels more and more put upon. And he does. He's exasperated, but I didn't do anything. And that's kind of the point. No, you didn't take any action. And guess what happens when you don't take action? Things happen to you. And then you have to either accept that the randomness of the world exists and carry on or not. Okay. So what I want you to listen to, though, is what Carter Burwell does in the transition from this completely disconnected parable to the rest of the movie that takes place in 1960s Midwest Jewish community.
Okay.
How he goes from one to the other using a cowbell. You know where we're going with this. Drums, an electric guitar, a bass, and wind.
Okay.
So this is the very beginning of the prologue, and this is the music that is playing and the scene in Yiddish. So I'll give you the basic construct of what's happening. This guy comes home, and he tells his wife, "You won't believe what happened to me." And it's like his cart broke down in the middle of this driving snowstorm. And he thought, "Oh, no, what am I going to do?" And then he happens to come across Feivish Finkel, who he knows as this guy that they know from the village, friend of a friend or whoever. Except his wife knows the guy that he says he just saw is dead. She knows for a fact that he died. So how is it possible that he could be alive? And she's convinced this is terrible. This is going to ruin them because it's the devil. This guy's the devil.
Yeah.
This is terrible, right? Well, then there comes, after they argue, there's a knock on the door, an ominous knock. And it's because the guy he invited Feivish Finkel over for soup. So they open the door, and there's Feivish Finkel and all his Feivish Finkel-ness, and he comes in. And it's a very friendly chat. Except that his wife grabs a knife and stabs Feivish Finkel. She stabs him in order to prove that she's right, that he's a devil. And when she stabs him, he looks down, and there's no blood, or very little. And he kind of looks up, and Feivish Finkel starts laughing. It's like, oh, God, he is a devil, right? Except then she says, see, I told you, he's a devil. And he says, you know, I'm feeling a little... I think maybe I don't want any soup. I should go home. And now he starts to really bleed, like the blood is pooling on his shirt.
Oh, no.
And so maybe he's just a man. So he gets up.
Oh, my God.
He gets up and he says, I know where I'm not wanted. And he walks out into the snow, into the night, and disappears.
Huh.
Was he real? Was he not?
Yeah.
Her response is... She says, blessed is the Lord, good riddance to evil. And then she slams the door shut. And that's when we go to the opening credits of a completely different film. And the music, this is where Burwell starts using wind and cowbells and drums and the electric guitar and the bass to transition from that prologue to Jefferson Airplane's Somebody to Love.
Wow.
So these are the opening credits are sort of coming at you. And you can imagine you just went from this really emotionally wrenching thing, like, what's going on? And now suddenly here's Jefferson Airplane.
Wow. That's quite a transition. That's great. This is one of the films I have not seen, and now I want to see it just for this transition.
Oh, you've got to see it, even just for the opening 10 minutes.
Okay.
But there's stuff in here about the uncertainty principle and the Schrodinger's cat.
Oh, man.
Oh, there's this film is one of those that will stay with you, and you will ponder it, and you will wonder, what was the point of this?
Okay, and so this brings us up to present. Man, these guys have quite a catalog of films.
They do. If we can, back in 2013, they did the film Inside Llewyn Davis, and I think we need to at least talk about it.
Yeah.
Again, T-Bone Burnett. Is sort of curating the soundtrack. He recorded Oscar Isaac, who plays Llewyn Davis, and others performing folk songs from the period. And the period in this film is the early 1960s in Greenwich Village, just as Bob Dylan is about to take hold.
And we should remind people that Oscar Isaac is...
Poe Dameron sings.
Poe Dameron.
Yes.
That's right. Star Wars.
And I got to tell you, listen to the soundtrack. He's got a great voice.
So this is actually him.
Yes, this is actually him singing.
Wow, okay.
He's terrific.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a good thing, because the rest of the film, it's okay. Now, they also did a documentary called Another Day, Another Time, celebrating the music of Inside Llewyn Davis. So if you check out the soundtrack and you really like it, try and track down the documentary as well.
When I go back Baltimore, need no carpet on my floor, you come along and follow me. We'll go down to Galilee. Howling green, green, rocky road. You're promenading green. Tell me who you love, tell me who you love.
So this has been quite a musical journey, an odyssey, if you will.
Yeah. It's been fun.
This has been really fun. I like, you know, the music in their films has always, you know, been this sort of character in and of itself. I've never really sort of sat down and thought about it. And I was really surprised to learn how much classical music there is in these films, too.
Well, and classical and folk and bluegrass.
Their range.
And gospel. It's everywhere. They cover
Or I guess Burwell's range.
Everything.
Yeah. Well, and the Coen brothers, because they're the
Coen brothers and T-Bone Burnett, and it's sort of a collaborative process, I imagine.
It's amazing. It's, and now I am going to have to go because I have to go home and watch all of these films.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially A Serious Man.
Yeah,
check
definitely. I'm going to. Well, Craig Coen, thanks so much for being on The Classical Classroom. This has been super fun. I'm glad we finally got to do it.
Well, thank you for having me on. This was a blast for me, and we got to get you back on Houston Matters sometime soon.
All right. It's a deal. All right, everybody, that does it for this episode. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You'll find links to all of our social media there. Make sure to follow us on the medium of your choice. Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes. Thanks today to audio producer Todd, A Serious Todd Holslander, for twiddling knobs. Thanks to Mark DiClaudio for his assistance and his piercing H.I. McDonough eyes. Thanks to Craig Coen for being on the show today. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for being here. We'll catch you next time.